This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Please take a moment and listen with me to a speech made on the floor of the U.S. Congress on September 14th, 2001. This is the voice of Representative Barbara Lee.
This unspeakable act on the United States has really forced me to rely on my moral compass, my conscience, and my God for direction. September 11th changed the world. Our deepest fears now haunt us. Yet I am convinced that military action will not prevent further acts of international terrorism against the United States. This is a very complex and complicated matter. Now, this resolution will pass, although we all know that the president can wage a war even without it. However difficult this vote may be, some of us must urge the use of restraint. Our country is in a state of mourning. Some of us must say, let's step back for a moment. Let's just pause just for a minute and think through the implications of our actions today so that this does not spiral out of control.
Representative Barbara Lee was the only member of Congress who voted against the 2001 authorization for use of military force. And she is with me now, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who represents the 13th District of California and is the only African-American woman in Democratic Party leadership, serving as co-chair of the Policy and Steering Committee. Representative Lee, thank you for being here.
Nice being with you, Melissa.
So your 2001 speech has now gone viral in the world of social media. I wanted us to take a moment to listen to it because of the strength of both your intellectual argument and your emotional force in that moment. Can you help us to understand how you are thinking and feeling now, 20 years later, seeing the events in Afghanistan?
Well, Melissa, I have to tell you, 20 years later, in many ways, I'm feeling the same way. Because, first of all, we have been in Afghanistan 20 years. In many ways, we've occupied the country. And now the pain and the fear and the anxiety that so many have, I have, in terms of seeing what's taking place and the and at least how this transition and withdrawal has taken place. Also, you know, I worry about making sure that we get everyone out, the evacuation. It's going a bit more smoothly now. But the Afghan allies, our American citizens, our diplomats, women, children, we've got to do this in a way that makes sure that no one is left behind to be placed in harm's way as it relates to the brutal kinds of treatment of the Taliban. So I'm worried right now about that. And I want to make sure we have the resources for the special immigrant visas. And, you know, I chair the subcommittee on appropriations that funds a lot of what is taking place now. So I'm feeling the pain and the suffering of people who have been through so much and hoping that we've learned a lesson that there's no military solution in Afghanistan, and that feeling very reflective in terms of where we were and where we are today and how President Biden, thank God, has stated publicly over and over again that a military presence there was not going to achieve any type of national security goals other than being there for possibly another 20 years.
Are there circumstances when there is a military solution?
You know, I'm not a pacifist, Melissa, and you have to look at the threats. The president always has the authority to use force. The military option is on the table all of the time. And so we need to reassert Congress's responsibility in determining when the use of force is necessary. That's one of the problems I had on 9/14. It was a broad, overly broad, 60-word authorization that said that any president could use force anywhere in the world in perpetuity. that is really the set the stage for what I call forever war. And so Congress's Article 2 responsibility is to debate and determine where and when and if the president should have authority to use force. And that's how you make those determinations. But I also have to say that we have many tools of our foreign and military policy, diplomacy, development, and defense. That needs to be, those three aspects of foreign policy must be reordered and reimagined and reframed and reshaped now. Because we have a military budget, for example, of $740 billion, whereas my budget, which is the diplomacy and development aspect of our foreign policy, is about $62 billion. And so we have to rebalance this and say that, you know, global peace and security can only be achieved if, in fact, you engage in development and diplomacy, at least on par with our use of force in the military option.
So as you are describing that reordering of priorities and resources associated with those priorities, that sounds to me like kind of leadership 101, right? This is what leaders do. So I want to ask you a bit about leadership here. If people can kind of remember all the way back to the 2008 presidential primary, there were Democratic candidates who had to apologize for their vote to authorize the military use of force. President Obama did not, but of course he also was not in a position to have voted for it. I am interested in the fact that President Biden stood really strong and unapologetic on his position. He said that the buck stopped with him. On a broad leadership perspective, Representative, what is the value of leaders who are able to say they're wrong? And when have you been wrong?
Well, I think leaders must say in many ways that they're wrong when they're wrong and look at how to present that in an honest way to the public. I think people really do appreciate integrity. And even if they don't agree with you, you know, saying, well, I've rethought it. I'm not sure if, in fact, this is what the right decision was. But now we're here and we're going to develop a path forward based on what the new information or the new strategy should be. And I think that takes a heck of a lot. In many respects, you know, sometimes we cast votes that aren't necessarily the votes we would like to cast. There have been, and I'm trying to remember, certain votes that maybe because we had to move a bill forward, I was wrong in casting that vote, but I did it because I knew that the alternative was so bad that if I didn't do it, things would be worse. You know, the perfect can't be the enemy of the good. And that's some of the dilemmas I think that most of us in Congress have, is when there are key policy measures or key votes that you have to cast. Some bills don't go far enough for me, but then tinker around the edges. But to just make some progress, you know, I'll vote for it and defend that. When, in fact, I know if the votes had been there, I would have voted a different way. And so those moments come with everybody. And you have to be clear with your constituents or with whomever that you cast a vote that you thought was not the correct vote, but things would have been worse had you not cast that vote. You know, it's that fine line. But when there are issues of moral conscience and issues of war and peace, and issues that really determine life or death, we have to stand firm on those issues.
I hear you describing a bit when you're saying sometimes there are bills that don't go as far as you like. I hear you describing one of the central challenges within the Democratic Party right now, the kind of, and maybe it's a bit overblown in media, but there is a, at least a little bit of a struggle here between maybe a more gradualist, somewhat more moderate perspective and a sort of swifter timeline, more, as we'll call it, progressive wing of the party. You're in leadership. How are you managing that?
Sure. It's my responsibility as a member of leadership, as an African-American, as a woman, as a progressive, to put those points of views and bring forward in our leadership meetings and in our strategies. It could be an alternative point of view, or it may be a consensus point of view. And so that's what's expected of me. So if I believe that, and if I'm with the caucuses that I belong to, I chair the caucus on poverty and opportunity. If I don't believe that this is going, any bill, for example, is not going to address systemic poverty, but leave so many people behind, a few people may benefit from it, then I speak up and try to negotiate and try to craft legislation that at least meets those bottom lines. And so, again, it's about being honest. It's about putting all of your cards on the table, making sure everyone knows where you're coming from. And it's not because it's you, but it's because you're reflecting the views of, again, the Congressional Black Caucus members, the Congressional Progressive Caucus members, our Women's Caucus. And you put all of that together. You synthesize it. You come up with agreement with every constituency that you're representing. And then you put that forward. And you have a seat at that table, as Shirley Chisholm said, and you don't go along to get along or play by all of the rules, because they naturally, all the rules weren't made for people of color, for African Americans. But you try to oftentimes change some of the rules so that perhaps those voices can be heard and the roadblocks aren't there. That's my job.
Now, some of that ideological struggle also plays out as a generational struggle. I think about some of the members of the squad, younger members, representatives who had to, you know, really sort of beat entrenched incumbents within the party in a hard-fought primaries in order to secure their seats. Does the Democratic Party, it was often made a big issue of the Republican Party, but does the Democratic Party have a bench problem, a mentoring problem, or is the Democratic Party developing a new cadre of leaders?
I think we've seen over the years a new cadre of leaders. And every election now you see, especially women of color. We've had the first two Native American women, Democratic women, elected in the last 5 years. And I think that there's a bench. I know in my district and throughout members of the CBC's district, there are many, many young people who are prepared, because we prepare them. We have internship programs. They work with us on campaigns. They attend our boot camps. They do phenomenal work. I have my Martin Luther King Freedom Center, young people who traveled with me for 12 years with Congressman John Lewis on the Faith and Politics Institute. And so we mentor young people day and night. And I think you see new members, younger members, more progressive members being elected to Congress. And that's what securing the future is all about.
If you want to know more about Barbara Lee, the new documentary about Representative Lee premieres this Friday on Amazon Prime. Representative Barbara Lee of California, thank you for joining me today.
Nice being with you.
On Tuesday, Texas Governor Greg Abbott tested positive for COVID-19. The perennially maskless chief executive of the Lone Star State is fully vaccinated, asymptomatic, and expected to be just fine in short order, which is great news because we have lost far too many people to this pandemic. In fact, my husband is in Texas right now for a family funeral because the coronavirus has claimed yet another one of our loved ones. And that the governor's positive status is unlikely to lead to a negative outcome is evidence of the effectiveness of available vaccines. But it might be hard to hear that message on a day when the Biden administration has announced that most vaccinated Americans will need booster shots and that distribution will start in September. Cue conspiratorial social media posts about the failure of the vaccine, which is, by the way, not what a suggested booster shot means. Confusion and misinformation continue to swirl, even as more than 900,000 new cases reported in the U.S. last week show the result of the highly contagious Delta variant. And oh yeah, school has restarted in much of the country. Kids under the age of 12 are still not eligible to receive the vaccine, which accounts for the dramatic spike in pediatric COVID infections in recent weeks. And since my 7-year-old will be in a second grade classroom in just 6 days, I knew it was time to get a little expert guidance on how this whole global pandemic situation is progressing. Here to help is Dr. Bhakti Hansoti, an associate professor of emergency medicine and international health at Johns Hopkins University and Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Hansoti, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
So we had a bit of a chat before going on air, and so I know that you are also the parent of even younger children, those who won't even be available or eligible for the next round of vaccine. But I got to tell you, just on a personal point of privilege, I want to start with this. When do we think that vaccines for 5 to 11-year-olds will become available?
Very, very soon. I was hoping for the first week of September to be receiving like that FDA EUA notification, but very, very soon. The studies have been completed. The trials have been done. There's a lot of data to comb through, but all indications that there will be approval and vaccines will be forthcoming shortly.
Okay. In the meantime, we know that Delta is more contagious. We know pediatric cases are up, but is Delta also more deadly?
So we are not seeing that Delta is more deadly. So the, you know, there's conflicting data. So studies from the United Kingdom, Scotland specifically, showed compared Alpha to Delta. And what they showed was that patients with Delta were significantly more likely to be hospitalized, but they did not show significant increases in deaths. In the United States right now, when you look at the COVID-19 statistics available online, what you can see, we have a soar of cases, we have a soar of hospitalizations, but we're not seeing that same uptake in death. And that could be due to lag time. It could be that the population that's unvaccinated is younger and has less likely to have comorbidities, but it could be a product of the Delta virus, which requires hospitalization, supplemental therapies, but may not be as likely to result in death.
Is it possible that we've gotten better at treating COVID over the past 18 months?
Absolutely. So we know so much more about how to manage these patients adequately. We have many more therapies now that are targeted to preventing progression of disease that are now available for individuals with mild to moderate illness. So like stop them from getting sick, like stop them from getting to the ICU. So I think doctors are also more confident in the COVID-19 patient and what works and what doesn't work.
Now, as my daughter prepares to go back into the classroom as a student, and I prepare to go back into the classroom face-to-face for the first time in a year and a half as a teacher, I'm trying not to just be mad all the time about folks who are not vaccinated. But I was also reminded, as I was kind of prepping around politics, teaching politics, that fear actually isn't very good at motivating action. It only really motivates inaction. So I'm wondering, is there a kind of joyful, hopeful way of getting people to want the vaccine?
Sure. So we know that children thrive through social interactions. We know this. There is evidence and science behind this. We also know that nothing is foolproof when it comes to COVID-19. It is a deadly virus. However, we have seen previously from our experience late spring last year that we can make schools as safe as possible. And there's well-established strategies such as masking, keeping children in social pods, routine testing, and routine symptom screening. And we know that these strategies have been effective. And we're lucky that when your child goes back to school in September, the weather will be still good. They can have many outdoor classroom opportunities. And so, you know, I have hope, right, that we can do this. We just need to adapt the way we do business.
Now, help me to understand a little bit the, so if you're an adult and you are vaccinated, you can still get COVID-19, right? We just know that you're not going to, you're pretty unlikely to get very sick from it. Are you able to then pass it to children who are not vaccinated? I'm just trying to understand all those pieces.
Absolutely. So what happens is when you get vaccinated, you have your immune system gets a kickstart, and it means that you are likely to suppress the virus and stop you from getting sick as quickly as possible. Everybody understands that. But the truth is you'll still have circulating virus. So you may be more likely to be asymptomatic while being infective, which means a child who is unvaccinated is susceptible to getting the virus from you. So adults who are vaccinated should still be masking in order to protect their children.
Should they be quarantining? I know that the governor of Texas right now is quarantining. If you get a positive diagnosis, is quarantining still the best?
Absolutely. That's a physical barrier that distances you from vulnerable adults or children from getting the virus.
Okay. Early on, we were talking about herd immunity. Where's the herd and where's the immunity here?
So herd immunity is when a significant amount of people have an immune response. So you decrease the likelihood of transmission in the community. Now, herd immunity depends on the number of total people with an immune response already, and that can be individuals who have gotten sick from COVID and have natural antibodies, or those who have been vaccinated and have antibodies. We're no way near the numbers needed for herd immunity.
What does it mean to say there's going to be a recommendation around booster shots? What does that tell us?
It tells us that basic immunology still is basic immunology 101, that you mount an antibody response when you get vaccinated. Over time, those antibodies will likely wane, and that booster shots will be needed to re-amplify antibody production. This is how most vaccines work, and this is completely normal and expected.
Do you have a sense of a way to counter what you know is coming in terms of the misinformation about the idea that booster shots, you know, constitute a failure of the vaccine?
You know, misinformation is really challenging to counter, and that is because it's based on beliefs that are not evidence-based. I think the only way we can counter misinformation is meeting people where they're at with their questions. And so, you know, I have a friend whose young son has a lot of questions about why he should get vaccinated and his fears and concerns. And meeting him where he's at is the only strategy that seems to work. And that is answering the questions as simply as possible and as transparently as possible. And transparently, you know, what I would say right now is that this is natural, that if you have your body gets exposed to something, it has an aggressive response. Over time, that response wanes just because they haven't been re-exposed. A booster shot gives you re-exposure and then re-amplifies immune response. And that we knew all along that booster shots would likely be necessary. But it depends on the type of vaccine and the type of individual, on how frequent those booster shots are and when they're going to be necessary.
I know the work that you're doing is not only domestic, but also global. Is it ethical or public health reasonable for Americans to be getting a third shot when so much of the world has not yet gotten a first shot?
You know, I think that's the biggest public health debate that's happening right now. So, you know, let's think about it from an epidemiologic perspective. We know that variants of concern emerge when there's high amounts of transmissible virus. And we know that unvaccinated individuals are more likely to have transmissible virus. And so if you have large volumes of individuals who are unvaccinated, then you're going to have new variants of concern emerging. So where should we put our resources at? Should it be more immunity for those who have some immunity? Or is it more beneficial to decrease the amount of circulating virus by getting vaccines to those who are unvaccinated? Now, what's complicated here is not only our lack of resources and the finite supply of vaccines that we have, but it's also the lag time. So the second issue that I keep on referring to is that over time, antibodies wane. And so for me, it's been since January since I've had my shot. I'm now in month number 8. I'm likely way more susceptible than I used to be to the Delta variant. And I'm a frontline healthcare worker. And so is my immunity at the level of those unvaccinated? Probably not. But what is that difference that we're trying to make up? So it's not only an ethical question, but it's an epidemiologic question that requires a lot of complex modeling.
Dr. Bhakti Hansoti, last time that you were with us, now I just find your capacity to explain actually very calming in what feels like a storm that just won't stop. Dr. Bhakti Hansoti is an associate professor of emergency medicine and international health at Johns Hopkins University and Bloomberg School of Public Health. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Me.
You know what that sound means. School is now in session. And with the start of school comes the arrival of some familiar faces. parents packing up school lunches, students bustling down the hallways, hopefully with 6 feet apart, and teachers frantically preparing their classrooms. But let's not forget our school nurses, who have taken on a lot of new responsibilities amid the COVID-19 pandemic.
For many of us, it's just doing a lot more than expected. We've been on the front line since the pandemic closed schools, you know, back in 2020. Many of us now work long hours of contact tracing, and a lot of us are planning for some to just play a key role in COVID testing. So basically, we're taking on the work of the public health department, but without adequate staffing or support. My name is Gloria E. Barrera. I'm currently a certified school nurse at a public high school outside of Chicago, and I also teach at several universities. I am the president of the Illinois Association of School Nurses.
Despite this critical role that they play, our schools have suffered from a shortage of school nurses for years. According to one study from the National Association of School Nurses, 25% of schools nationwide did not have a school nurse. And that shortage, on top of the pandemic, has led to some burnout among school nurses.
Many, especially those in the trenches, are repeatedly exposed to high levels of stress and direct trauma. So like soldiers, some may return from this battle with psychological scars that run deep from their time at the front lines.
For more on the experience of school nurses amid the pandemic, I spoke with Linda Mendonca, president of the National Association of School Nurses. And she started by telling me a bit about the pathway into school nursing.
So it involves making sure that the school nurse has some knowledge level around education courses as well. So it involves more coursework to become a school nurse. So the National Association of School Nurses, currently we have approximately 18,000 members across the country.
For parents, or maybe for those of us, you know, who remember our school nurse as a young person, we might think of them as like just the friendly, nice lady in the office. And I just wanted to sort of remind our listeners the level of professionalism required.
Thank you. I appreciate that, because the misinformation, reputation, if you will, of being the Band-Aid nurse or the ice pack nurse. And clearly the role is much more than that, where school nurses are monitoring students' routine immunization records, making sure they're in compliance for the beginning of a school year for required immunizations. They take care of students with chronic health care needs, diabetes, asthma, seizure disorders, for example. They monitor, yes, ill children and children with injuries, but it's a big care coordination effort that school nurses are involved in on a day-to-day basis.
So take that overall role and help us understand it in the context of the fight against COVID-19. What kinds of responsibilities have school nurses taken on over the course of the past year and a half? And how does it look different with remote education?
So, yeah, it's been challenging last 18 months. And technically, we're like moving into a third school year that's being impacted by this pandemic. And the school nurse is really an essential member on the pandemic preparedness team for reopening and reentering plan teams in their districts. At the local level, school nurses have collaborated with public health authorities in the implementation of federal and state health and education guidance. So looking at all of those different guidances and what works best for their school community around COVID-19 mitigation strategies. So the school nurse has established partnerships and collaborations for really trying to do this work and to make sure that their school communities are healthy and safe for when, you know, students and staff are coming back this school year.
So help me out here. What's been the role of school nurses in COVID vaccine efforts so far?
They were there helping to do school located vaccine clinics. However it was rolled out, you know, different in every state, how the vaccine was rolled out. And they were there to really get those faculty and staff immunized. And then it became available for our student population, 12 and up. And again, taking a big role in coordinating clinics and getting their students vaccinated. So they'll be ready when the vaccine becomes available for children under 12. So as far as the mental health goes, that's a concern. We are all dealing with mental health, not just our students, but I think we all are in some form. living through this unprecedented pandemic in our lives. And so we are concerned about the mental health of our students and our staff and faculty returning. Many have not been in the classroom in some places in over, 18 months or so. They've been living, doing their learning at home. And so for them to come back into the school setting, it may produce some anxiety. And so we need to be ready and have that on our radar, returning to the school setting and making sure that we have resources. And I would just add one important piece where parents really can help is that our communication. School nurses really are key to communicating information to families, but it needs to be a two-way street where the parent communicates to the school nurse as well and to the school. So really establishing a clear line of communication and collaboration is really vital more now than ever as we continue, to navigate this pandemic together.
Do school nurses right now have a collective position, even if it's not every single school nurse, but is there a kind of institutional or organizational position, one about their own immunization status relative to the COVID vaccine, not immunization, but rather vaccination status, and secondly, about in-person schooling, given the realities of the Delta variant?
Right. So we do have a position. It's actually located on our website around returning to in-person learning. And it basically states that we support what the American Academy of Pediatrics has come out with around returning to school and universal masking to keep, all students, faculty and staff safe in the school environment. Of course, vaccination, whether it's COVID vaccine or, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, we clearly support immunizations as a public health measure or strategy to save lives and to keep people safe from acquiring any virus or disease.
School nurses are overwhelmingly women, is that right?
Correct, yes. That's what our demographic data has shown, yes.
And I'm wondering if there are pay differentials, if there are differences in sort of, workplace stress experiences, but sort of the ways that some of these equity issues might affect nurses themselves.
Right. So I think, again, pay is different across our country, right? Cost of living varies across the country. So that's certainly going to impact pay. Many school nurses are paid on teacher salary schedules. So that salary looks a little different than what they could make perhaps in a hospital setting. And then other places also have a separate pay scale for an RN, for example. So it definitely does vary. I think our workforce diversity is important. It's important to our organization, and we're really trying to focus and look at that a little bit more and really how can we make our workforce look a little bit more diverse. And the equity around pay has been a problem for many years, I think, for school nurses. I think being on the teacher's salary schedule is usually favorable, and it is, better than being on a separate schedule, because I'm not sure that sometimes the education world realizes the value of the nurse and what the nurse can bring to the table and into the school community and what, their pay as opposed to what it would look like in the hospital or acute care setting.
Do you think the pandemic is going to encourage state legislators, cities, schools to invest more in school nurses?
I certainly hope so. I do think that it will. I believe that they have realized the value. The school nurse brings this public health expertise to the table, to the school, and has that knowledge to do that. And they have been invaluable throughout this entire pandemic. So the American Rescue Plan, for example, that provided funding, $500 million to hire school nurses. And that money was, is being spread out throughout the country for states to invest and to do that. How that, I don't have data to tell you what that's looking like or where, what that will, the outcome will be. But we're hoping that that's, that that's what happens. The School Nurse Act that is in Congress has been introduced a couple of times. And we're hoping to move that forward as well, to provide equity and to make sure that there are school nurses in our schools across the country.
Linda Mendonca is the president of the National Association of School Nurses. Linda, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us. Really appreciate you inviting the National Association of School Nurses.
I'm not a school nurse, but I am a teacher. Funny thing is, we actually don't have a school nurse, and all teachers who are already spread thin are basically part-time nurses as well. Gia, calling from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi, my name is Marcus. I'm from Palmetto Bay, Florida. When it comes to being a school nurse, I've already reached about 10 years as a school nurse in Palmetto Bay. And I would say that what it means to me as of right now when it comes to the current situation going on with the COVID pandemic is that to stay strong, focus on what needs to be done when it comes to taking care of medically fragile children, and staying the course in a way that as long as I do my part, then I can contribute to helping, making sure that together, you know, as a link in the chain, together we can work together and get through this kind of pandemic. So as long as we work together in unison, be safe, wear our masks, get our vaccinations, taking precautions wherever we can, and washing our hands, then ideally we can put this COVID pandemic behind us sooner rather than later.
You're back with The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Now do me a favor. If you're not driving and if you're somewhere safe, just go ahead and lean back. Let your eyes go soft and relax. It's time for a little therapy on The Takeaway. Now, we know the past few months have been pandemic whiplash. April, get your vaccine. May, take off your mask. June, hug your family, see your friends. Have a hot vax summer, as you young people declared it. Then, in July, the Delta variant entered the group chat. And as one writer at the Dear Pandemic Advice column called it, the pandoomerang began. Don't get worked up. We're going to work it through. And back with us is Dr. Jessica Stern, clinical psychologist and clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at NYU Langone Health. Welcome back, Dr. Stern.
Of course, thanks for having me.
So you were actually on the show back in January and talked about how we had hit kind of a pandemic wall about a year into the pandemic. It's now 18 months in, and it looks like we're about to crest on another wave of this. A lot of us are feeling pretty exhausted. What are you seeing? Is that exhaustion shared beyond the production room of The Takeaway?
Yes, absolutely. That exhaustion just spans across so many different types of people, so many walks of life. And it's back. It's what I'm thinking of as existential dread turning into existential fatigue, which is the continual anxiety and hopelessness and confusion that continues to compound over and over again. And it's exhausting.
So, you know, I sometimes think of mental health challenges or mental health illnesses as being a somewhat unrealistic response or over response or under response to world stimuli. But this feels not so much like a mental health problem as like an accurate assessment of living in a global pandemic.
Yes, most definitely. That's such a great way of putting it. Is in a lot of cases, the anxiety that we're having is very realistic and very valid. And it's even just beyond anxiety. It's just this general burnout and, like I said, fatigue that is just so incredibly pervasive. And it's this large dark cloud that just is sitting there and keeps sitting there and keeps sitting there.
So what do we do? How are the strategies different now? Because I'll say, as much as it was hard in the first year, I went ahead and got into it. I painted my basement. I turned it into a yoga room. I was like, we're about to do this. I can just be home for a few months, work from home, because I had that particular privilege. But I got to tell you, I don't even want to go down to the yoga room no more. I'm not like, we must need some new strategies. I don't know if I can deep breathe my way through the rest of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a couple of pieces here. I think one is to take stock of what's happening around you and the types of things that are affecting you. And I think what's so challenging is that this time around, we've gotten the what was almost promised to be the gold token, which is a vaccine, which has been tremendously important. And I very highly endorse getting the vaccine. The struggle is that the pandemic is not over yet with the vaccine. And I think that's what's leading people to feeling overwhelmed. And so to find the things that are exhausting to you or anxiety provoking to you or stressful to you, which might be compounded by current events that are happening in the world, and see where are your triggers coming from, talk to the folks that are in your life, and see if there are ways that you can create boundaries in your life, and also as best as possible to create new routines. I think a lot of us have fallen into the routine that we started in March 2020, June 2020, et cetera, and we've kind of gotten quote unquote comfortable. It's not comfortable, but we've gotten used to it. And so whatever we can do to shift that, try new things, and find a way to create fresh experiences for ourselves, I think can be really monumental here.
You know, certainly part of what happened for those of us who did have the privilege to work not, you know, in our location, is it's also true, though, that work became 24/7, right? It's always on. It's always there. I mean, it really isn't unusual for me to be on a Zoom at 7 o'clock at night.
What's exactly like you're saying, what's so difficult is that there aren't clear distinctions between work life and personal life and all of these different things. And what happens is that these things bleed into each other and we're in this constant state of whiplash. You use the word whiplash, and I think that the word here applies in so many different ways. And here we're constantly having to do what we sort of refer to in the field as shifting sets. So going from one set to another, so work life to taking care of the kids to personal life to going to yoga. And what's happening is the more we do that and shift between one to another to another to another, it becomes really exhausting. And so whatever you can do to create boundaries in your life between activities, and also boundaries with people where need be, can be very protective. And it can be hard, but I would encourage people to take a look at what's around them and see where can I trim things. And where can I potentially categorize things such that I'm protecting my energy in a way that's helpful for me?
Let me push back from the privilege banquet for a second and point out that many people are actually working in the front lines, whether it's restaurant workers, doctors, nurses, and now educators going back into the classroom in many states where they may feel quite unprotected. For folks whose burnout is not just about sort of bleeding lines of, of lack of boundary, but really about genuinely being on the front lines, what are some of the tools?
Yeah. So what I would say is there are a couple of pieces here, and I can make recommendations for the employees, but also to the leaders and employers. Whatever you can do to advocate yourself for yourself. And I know that that's tricky because in some cases that advocacy doesn't take you very far and in some cases can actually compromise your job. But where possible, if you can advocate for yourself around what feels comfortable and what feels safe, can be really important. And my biggest plea to employers and to leaders is to check in with your staff, to check in with the people that you are employing and ask them what they need. To very please, please, please ask them what they need, because they might not feel empowered or safe to tell you what they need, and making assumptions about that can be hard. So do little focus groups, do one-on-one check-ins and ask. It can be really, really important. And I think we really need to take care of our workforce one to another person.
And how about kids? I know we've been seeing a rise in mental health and anxiety circumstances for teens and adolescents and even young children.
Yeah, it's scary to see that happening. It's very scary, especially because early on in the pandemic, we thought that kids were much better protected. And to a certain extent, they were previously. But now we're seeing that protection is not extending in the way that we thought. And so we're seeing a lot of kids and teenagers getting ill, and it's really scary. And so I would say similar things for parents. Whatever you can do to advocate for yourself, whether that's in the school place, whether that's in after school activities, whether that's with other parents too, is to find your advocacy and also more importantly to set your boundaries where possible. That can be really important. There's another place where boundaries I think comes really, really much in handy, is to check in about that. We really got to protect the kids because they really need our help here.
Dr. Jessica Stern is a clinical psychologist and clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at NYU Langone Health. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, y'all, that's all we have today. And listen, I know that the last couple of days the show has been pretty heavy, and really the news has been pretty heavy right now. And although we did talk about mental health there, I do want to just say, if you are feeling down, if your loved ones are feeling down, there is no shame in reaching out for help beyond your takeaway therapy session. This is the time. Ask for help. We all need a little help to get through it all. So just in case, the number for the National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 1-800-273-8255. And of course, call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And yeah, this is The Takeaway.